question, I'll put it in the form of a question. Do we know where those people whose, where the new jobs, where the people came from?
We don't know where the people come from, but we know what industries they're in and what, you know, what, where those jobs are. And they're not all in healthcare.
But we don't know also where they work, where they work.
No, and it depends on, you know, some of them are people who, whose now their salary is being paid for out of Medicaid, and then that leaves money that's going to someplace else. It's, you know, that's one of the challenges anytime on an economic impact. You don't know unless somebody's physically moving. But what it is it's dollars that are supporting those jobs in the economy. And if you were at full employment, you'd be adding a lot of new jobs. If you're not at full employment, those jobs are now supported by a revenue source that wasn't there before. I mean, the thing with this one that's interesting is it's, you know, in Pennsylvania's case, it's $4 billion that wouldn't be in Pennsylvania absent Medicaid expansion. All right, because those dollars aren't coming.
That's money.
Well, but those dollars aren't coming into the state otherwise. And, you know, the taxes are still being paid by the folks who are paying for that at the end of the day. And so that's the dilemma and that's the challenge. It's an investment. It's all ultimately an investment type of decision in the economy.
Actually, I think my colleagues at eConsult probably could have figured out where the people came from.
No, actually, I've asked that because they did the work for us. Oh. So.
let me ask everybody to be quick in their questions and quick in their responses because we've got a lineup here. Dallas?
Right, now that we've gotten that mandate, I did have a comment and a question. I just wanted to quickly respond to Tim Joe's excellent question about sort of state readiness. You know, there are about, according to a Kaiser study that was put out in January of 2013, there are about, I think it was about 47 states had already taken up the 90-10 FMAP, you know, bump for eligibility system transformation to prepare for MAGI and streamlined eligibility. So there is evidence that states are doing this, and actually according to our work with states, they are very actively engaged with CMS on both their implementation and contingency plans. Not sure whether everyone's going to make it there, but there is a lot of work going on underneath the surface that never gets talked about. We all talk about Medicaid expansion because it's very flashy. I did also want to comment along those lines that Dr. Sunwell, your state is an amazing leader in this respect, in that it is one of the few states that already has an incredible eligibility IT system in place, and it's the leader in the country, so I was surprised that you didn't mention it, but I will.
It is. It's called eRIM.
Yes.
And we've had it for a few years. Cost us a bundle, and any of you have had this experience when you implement it, they said, oh, by the way, we need about 10 million, 20 million more. But anyhow, we got there, and if you look at our agreement with HHS now, it is the federal exchange will be linked to EREP, our electronic eligibility system.
But it's paying state great dividends. It's more than paid for itself on return for investments. That may be an area of small state savings in the future. The question that I really wanted to get to, though, which I think is prompted by the excellent presentations that were made this morning, is just, We know that about half the states or more, perhaps, we're going to be seeing this newly uninsured population below 100% of the federal poverty level. And yet, in most states that we've been talking to, there doesn't seem to be too much of a plan for how to manage this newly, more glaringly uninsured population. And given the amazing brains in this room, I just wanted to pose for the panelists and for the group, you know, sort of what constructive planning should states or others, providers or others, be doing to get ready for what we know is going to be a very challenging situation, both for states, for the feds who have to turn these folks away when they come in thinking they're eligible and they're getting nothing, and for the safety net, given that the safety net may be facing, you know, a dish cut on the horizon and the absence of a coordinated safety net in many states.
Won't it just be the status quo, just more uninsured? Anybody make any plans?
Well, it'll be less uninsured, but it'll be that the core group that isn't, just keep worried about it.
Speak up.
I appreciate you mentioning the safety net because I think that's part of the challenge. There, I've always felt even if there were universal coverage, there would be a certain group of people who will not be welcome in traditional places. We'll always need a public health system parallel to our private system. And I think that, well, like I say, I'm proud that in Utah we at least have three public health clinics funded by the state. But we have about 49 others, whether it's federally qualified health centers. I think they're going to be increasingly important when you shortchange them, even though more people have insurance coverage.
I'm watching the clock. We've got three lines. Susan Denser, David Blumenthal, Helen.
So my question goes back, picks up on Mark's excellent question about employment shifts.
we tried that. And, you know, there's a high level of skepticism that you're just rationalizing the decision. So for us, we defaulted back to, look, what is the specific effect on the state treasury? We can measure that exactly, and then we let others measure kind of other economic impacts, including for us, the Health Policy Institute in Ohio that found almost exactly the same sort of findings. So we believe in those findings, but had to take a more conservative position to make our case, because I think there is this idea that, well, these jobs are fungible, that, you know, are you really creating jobs? Now, for us, we did some specific things, like we reprocured our entire managed care plans in January this year, and we wrote into their contracts things that had to be located in Ohio. And that generated to a net pickup of 3,500 jobs in Ohio that we think we probably stole from other states. You know, the call center was there and they moved it to Ohio. So I get for the country, that's not a gain in jobs, but for Ohio right now it was. So there are some specific things that tie directly to real jobs, but in most cases, the jobs piece was not a compelling political argument for us.
So in our case, we did the study, RAND also produced jobs, Families USA did a study that had jobs. Our independent fiscal office produced everything but the jobs. They just didn't mention the jobs, they had to in order to get the tax information. But I think the fiscal impact is very important on all of this. And the fiscal impact does depend on the jobs because there are revenues that are generated and there are other aspects that go along with that. I think when you're looking, it is a job, is a job, is a job. Where it's actually important in Pennsylvania is in some of the rural communities, where the hospital or the health center are the primary employer, and that funding supports those jobs, which could be at risk if you take away other parts of the funding stream.
And I think sometimes it depends on who the messenger is. Sometimes these studies are commissioned by progressive leaning groups, and so they're just dismissed. The science is not credible, whether it is or not.
This is not a healthcare question. It is striking to see the polarization that is present in the federal government creeping into the state government. And I guess it's not surprising because it's the state legislatures that gerrymandered the federal districts. Is there any discomfort, is there any buyer's remorse with the gerrymandering of local districts? Are state representatives happy to be running against the extremes in their own party rather than against more moderates from the other party? Do you see any prospect that they may actually is?
Next question.
I'll just say it's fascinating living in Utah. We don't have any real Democrats. We have. Because I'm also real Democrats. I know how crazy and wild liberal we can be, but we have just some hardcore moderate Democrats, very reasonable folks. And Jim Matheson, by the way, in spite of the chairman, he still won his election by air over a very promising young black woman who's a Republican challenged him. But it is fascinating to see the shift, and it's difficult because we don't have a two-party system. We've got the old-fashioned Republicans like me and then this new breed that are frustrating our lives like many others.
You know, I think we should not be quick to judge to know if there is a way that the new thing can work. The problem is there's kind of this 1-2 hit of term limits and these gerrymandered districts. And that combination in many places has created polarization. People are trying to lead the way they were trained to lead when that was not the circumstance. And those skills are ineffective in the current environment. Can people adapt in the new environment and make that effective? I think there's maybe a version where if you have more extreme views and you figure out how to create in between, maybe there's even a positive. But the problem is folks have not found, as a matter of leadership, folks are not finding a way to make it work.
Yeah, I think at both the federal level and at the state level, it's the problem for leaders. You know, it's the leadership of the legislatures that are trying to figure out what this model is for them. Their seat is safe, and they're there. But how do you deal with, the old horse trading may not work the way it used to work because that's anathema and that can cause a primary. You know, we're trying to do gas tax at the same time. Usually that would mean you get a project in your district. That's not necessarily a positive right now, I'd say.
From the home of Olympia Snow, the United States Senate for this reason, I think we have to look at the party apparatus. So part of the reason is the party apparatus increasingly has been taken over by more conservative, or more fringe, if you will.
More working fringe.
Yeah, and I think that's probably right. In our state, what we've seen is the rise of independents. And the reason we have a Tea Party governor is because we tend to have three-way, five-way, six-way races for governor. And so that splits the vote, and you know, anybody who has a consolidated basis, the Tea Party does, can win.
So I hear the answer is there's no prospect of...
It's always going to get better. All right, we're not trying to borrow from one. And I've got... we've got two more. We've got Heather and then Sandy.
So I'd be interested to hear from y'all, Heather Howard from Princeton. I'm worried that in terms of the Medicaid expansion, there's a timing problem. If you can't get it done this year, can you get it done next year when that window of 3 years of the government paying 100% is closing, right? And so everyone's always assumed that, like, the history of Medicaid takeoff, states would take off the expansion over time. But is it fair to assume that, given that that window is going to be closing on the 100%?
Let me just quickly say, as I understand it, Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, if we might do a partial expansion, that window doesn't matter. You're still going to get your traditional match rate.
Yeah, you could do it, but the 100% funding is only the first
time. I understand that. So yeah. You'll pass up on that, but you could still expand, but not get that enhanced rate.
Because there's not a deadline, the answer to that is political. And that's why we've said this has to be done by June 30 this year, because we believe if it's not, then we have a year headed into 2014 that is going to be highly political. And so I think it either for us, it happens soon or not.
But I think you alluded to something in your presentation that's quite real. And with the negotiation that Andy was able, and Arkansas was able to play through with CMS, it sort of upped the stakes. So now you have legislatures and governors saying, no, wait a minute, let's hold out. The federal government wants us to participate. Let's hold out and see what we can get for the deal. And I think that there's a significant amount of that playing back and forth. And I don't know how realistic it is, because I'm not sure what can really be given.
And could I comment quickly on that to kind of dispel, I think, a misconception? I think the federal government made a very wise decision in not cutting a series of one-off state deals. They basically said, look, we have this existing authority for states to use to buy in, use premium assistance to buy into private insurance. Nobody's ever done it because it has to be budget neutral and we can't figure out how to get it to work, so it's never been acted on. They said, we'll look the other way on budget, no, we'll waive budget neutrality to make that an option. That option then is available really to any state that wants to pick that up. Now, it would be done as a demonstration, and you can't have 50 demonstrations. So presumably there would be a smaller list of states. But that is available to Arkansas as it is to Ohio, as it is to any state. That's very different than holding out for kind of a one-off deal, which I think would create an environment where folks just wait and wait and wait for a better deal. If states are doing that,
yeah, they are.
They're not going to get that.
I think that's right. That's 100% right. But I think we have to hope that CMS retains sort of its policy backbone as it's confronted by more and more states asking for sort of help. So let me go to the last. We're going to do this on time. Cindy Greger?
A partial response to David and then a question for the panel. It's interesting. Kansas, I would venture to say, is as red, certainly as red as Utah.
Well, you're one of those holding out.
Well, I don't want to get into that argument. It's not fun. But what we see is moderate Republicans were targeted in the last election because they didn't go along with the conservatives and lost. That's not a surprise. But now there's a gridlock because the conservatives are trying to out-conservative each other, and they're not. So I'm curious as to whether, I mean, is gridlock going to be there regardless of what the political dynamic is? You're always going to have folks. It doesn't matter if you're in the same party. It seems like we've got the gridlock even worse now than we have when we had moderates willing to work with Democrats. At least that was an ideologic appropriate
I really agree with you. I think a lot of us have a lot of consternation over this situation and don't know where it's going. But, Fish, I'm not in any way being offensive, but I think it's best not to use terms like a moral imperative, implying that if you're not going to vote for it, you're immoral. Mm-hmm. And I think it's those kinds of things that we need to build rapprochement, or to get beyond this gridlock. We really need to be respectful of these different points of view. I would suppose many people in Utah, maybe Kansas, think it's immoral to further contribute to the deficit. And we're going to hell if we keep doing this. And so it's just going to take caution and care, real thoughtfulness on the part of all of us who are interested in public health or population health or individual families to get these public programs that serve them and get beyond this silly ideology.
We'll close on an upbeat note. Thank you for